Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen. It's December 29th, 2016. My name is Kirk Hamilton, and we have got a great show for you today. We have a surprise special guest in the studio, as game developer Matthew S. Burns, who fans of the show will know from past appearances, happened to be in Portland, and I invited him on the show, and he said yes, so he is now in my apartment to join me and Jason to talk about making video games, specifically working at Zachtronics, where he recently helped ship Shenzhen.io, their latest game. We also talk about the new Nier Automata demo, the Double Fine documentary, The Majesty of Controller Under Buttons, and at the end, have a spoilery discussion of Rogue One. It's going to be fun. Stick around. Welcome back to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen, a special surprise guest episode of Kotaku Split Screen. I am sitting in my apartment in Portland right now with our guest. Before that, I am also joined by the one and only Jason Schreier from New York City. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Kirk. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm excited to be joined by our surprise guest, who I heard was in Portland yesterday. And then we got lunch, and I said, "Hey, do you want to come be on a podcast?" And he said, "Yes," because he's great. Frequent, or at least multiple time, Kotaku Split Screen guest, Matthew Burns. Hey, Matthew.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good. Matthew is now doing narrative and music at Zachtronics, where he most recently worked on the game Shenzhen.io, which some of you, if you play really nerdy games on Steam, probably know about.
Is a super nerdy game. And he made the best work productive music.
It's true.
That you will hear in a long time.
Yeah, Jason and I both work quite a bit to your soundtrack. It's very good. It just always feels like I'm making progress because the music just builds.
That's
good.
Yeah, that's what it's designed to do, make you feel like you're
just making progress. So, quick programming note before we start chatting. So, we were supposed to do our Games of the Year episode this week, but because of some scheduling issues, we have had to bump that to, I think we're going to do it next week.
Can we figure out a way to blame it on Matthew instead?
All Matthew Burns.
Yeah. He showed up and ruined
hey
everything.
Hey guys, can I be on your podcast?
And we were like, well, we were going to do it. So anybody who's disappointed right now, we're disappointed too.
Matthew.
It's Matthew's fault.
Yeah. Fucking damn it. So we will do that next week, most likely.
Yeah.
So if you came in this week expecting to hear our every single game of 2016 episode, you will be disappointed. I am deeply sorry.
Though hopefully you'll find something to like in this podcast episode as well. We'll see.
I sure hope so.
It remains to be seen.
We hope so.
Yes, it remains to be seen how this will go. So I think we got a lot of things to talk about today. So at the end of this episode, we're going to talk a little bit about Star Wars Rogue One, because we all saw it, and it's a safe bet that a lot of our listeners saw it too, and we haven't talked about it yet, so we'll save that for the end of this conversation. But for now, let's talk about video games, specifically a demo that I played of the new Nier game, Nier Automata, I believe it is called.
I love that it's called Nier Automata.
Yeah, like it's not quite Automata. It's just,
you're near to the...
You're just near. It's just Nier.
No, it's just a bizarre name. It's just a...
Yeah.
That's serious. Did you play the first one, Kirk?
I did not. Can you tell me, maybe, I know you both have played it, right?
Yeah, I played it. I'm not sure I could describe it. It's hard to describe.
Jason, how would you describe it?
It's just kind of a weird cross between... Well, it's mostly an action RPG, so that's the best way to describe it. Mm-hmm. But like at certain points, at what point it becomes a text adventure, at what point it becomes... there's a lot of like bullet hell aspects to it. And it's just a very bizarre, interesting game. I actually didn't love it. A lot of people love it. It's become this kind of well-regarded cult classic.
Yeah, I hear from people all the time. It's just another one of those games where people say, oh, you didn't play the first Nier. You really need to play it. And I'm like, dude, after Suikoden. But I gather that the game significantly unfolds in New Game Plus.
You have to get the full story. You have to play it like three or four times.
You have to beat
it
like four times to get the the best ending or
Most clear. It's funny because I feel like I guess Dishonored 2 is the same way in a different way, but I've like that game finally.
It's a little different for this one. Yeah. The story is like actually incomplete until you've played it,
and things just change, right? Like it's just a different game when you play it again. Yeah,
yeah.
It's an interesting design. I feel like the first Nier is definitely like more interesting than it is necessarily like good or polished, right? It's like it's playing with a lot of cool ideas that are fun to experience.
And I actually didn't know it was an action RPG. I feel like the dude in the game looks a little bit like Geralt of Rivia, which is funny because The Witcher is an action RPG too, but I always looked at it and was like, oh, so it's like a weirder version of The Witcher. And then
you were probably the first person on the planet to have compared Nier to The Witcher.
Am I really, or are you kidding? I feel like
Geralt? There's nothing like one another. Okay.
You're talking about the version of the character that they made for more Western audiences.
See, I haven't played. Right.
Jason,
well, I guess
do you know
I haven't
about this?
Played the
they
game
tried
at
to,
all.
Like, yeah, they made they like a different him, yeah. really? Character, and they made him like make they made him look more like burly and.
So you'd appeal
Western
to Americans.
Masculinic. Yes.
Yeah, no, they thought that would be a big... Weird. They actually changed the heroine of the story to, I believe she was his sister or his wife, and then they changed her to his daughter.
Yeah. Oh, because we got to have more dads.
She is his sister in the Japanese version. They're like, well... People in America like dad games,
right,
where you're like
right.
a dad protecting his daughter.
Right,
so we need to,
right. The dadification.
That's like...
This is before The Last of Us. This was before all the real,
oh, really?
The real rise of the dad
games.
Yeah,
they were ahead of the curve on this.
Before the
dad
great
thing.
Dadening of games kicked in.
Right, they were in on it. Though.
Trademark Steven Totillo. So the sequel is very striking, kind of Bayonetta, Devil May Cry-like game, starring a really hot robot chick who, you know, wears a short skirt and has a huge sword and kind of kicks ass. And I didn't know anything going in except that people were excited about it, and I had seen that Fahey wrote about the demo for us and said it was great. And I'm into demos right now anyways, because it's sort of cool that like there's a Gravity Rush 2 demo and a Nier Automata demo, and there was a demo
You're
for
into
Shadow
demos
Tactics
right now,
they're just all these demos, and it's sort of fun to download demos and just play them, even though I'm gonna play the full game pretty soon. So I thought, well, what the hell, it was last night, I was playing through stuff for our Game of the Year discussions, but actually that's weirdly overwhelming sometimes, and I wind up just going and playing other things that don't have anything to do with our Game of the Year discussion, just because, I don't know, it's
You're saying
weird...
that the Nier Automata demo is not going to be our Game of the Year?
No, maybe it'll be Game of the Year. Well, I guess it could be 2016. It'll be on our list. Yeah. Just the best demos. The Gravity Rush
like Overwatch,
demo, games that didn't even come
The
out.
Witness, Nier Automata demo.
That would be good. It would be good if we gave the Overwatch beta... on our Game of the Year. That was the best version of the game. Anyway, I played it. It's really fascinating. So I'll describe it to you guys, and I showed a little bit of it to Matthew before we recorded. But so it's, you know, it's a third person, like really like aggressive sort of Japanese DMC like style action game. I mean, you're doing double jumps and like lunges in the air, and you're juggling enemies and doing big combo moves with like huge swords and kind of moving really fast. And there's even a dodge, kind of like Bayonetta's dodge. If you time it right, you like do this really cool effect. It's like running at 60 frames per second. It's really fast. It's really aggressive. And so there's that part of the game, but then the camera keeps changing, really dramatically changing perspective. So suddenly it's totally top down, and then you're playing, like a bullet hell game, and you're moving around, and the enemies are sort of shooting at you from all directions, and you're shooting around. And then in one really cool part, you're like, it goes totally sideways, and it becomes a side scroller, and you're going around this huge building. And it's the same kind of deal, like enemies are coming from both sides and you're jumping over them. And it's really cool because the moveset translates extremely well from one type of game to another. And the camera really seamlessly just she'll get off a ladder and then suddenly it pulls in behind her and you're back in, you know, in a regular third person view. And it's really slick and really cool. And I was just, it's kind of amazing how many different modules they fit into this one demo. Like I only played for like half an hour or something.
Yeah,
I feel like I went
like
through
Nier.
Like six different games. It was So is there, like, did the first Nier have more of a story element? Like, were there parts where, with dialogue, and did you go around and talk to people?
I mean, yeah, there's definitely a story to it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a vague, strange story that is kind of revealed, well, like I mentioned before, when you played it three or four times, you really learn what the story is about. But yeah, and there's a text adventure part that is entirely
When you say that, just spoil me or whatever. Like, what does that mean?
It just pops up a text window and you have choices at the very bottom, and it goes on and on. And when you first find it, it's like, oh, this is kind of funny. And you start making choices, and then it just lasts longer and longer and longer. You can play, I don't remember how long it is, but it's like a pretty full on, like,
well, it's a full, the way, from what I remember, the game is structured so that there are different areas and you have to like conquer each or finish each area, right? And there's one that was a forest, and you go in expecting to be like, okay, I'm going to go fight some more monsters and do this whole action level. And then it just turns into a text adventure and describes you walking through the forest, and that's how you play it. It's really bizarre.
It's a really interesting
and
choice.
Crazy.
Yeah. I wonder if that's like they wanted to do that from the beginning, or that's just like a thing that they ended up doing because they like ran out of time.
They just tossed it for it. Yeah. Just make this section.
You
text
are
based.
In a forest. Like, oh, that's easy.
Man, more games should do that.
There's a great story about Monkey Island, how you guys, I assume, both played the first Monkey Island game, how you're playing as Guybrush Threepwood and you're invading Elaine's mansion, and then they wanted to do this whole crazy setup where like you would get attacked by all these things and all these things would collapse.
Yes.
And then they couldn't actually afford to make all the assets and make all the art and sound effects for it. So instead, they just had Guybrush go like behind the wall. And
that's
you just
one of the best jokes in that game. Like the prompts are right. Like, it's like, use like flamethrower on like horde of dragons or like horde of dogs that's attacking you, and it just becomes totally.
It's so good, and it's such a good example of like how limitations can lead to such great creativity and make for better games a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. I remember reading a really good interview with the director of Final Fantasy VI, Kitase, who said that he thinks one of the reasons Final Fantasy VI was so great is because of the limitations they had in development,
I feel like that's been said of Star Wars as well. Considering that I have Star Wars on the mind, like the first Star Wars was a nightmare to make and was apparently just hellish. But because they had to make all these creative, you know, changes on the fly, it actually wound up with a more interesting
which
movie.
Makes you a good segue to talk about what Matthew
because yeah
been
I don't
to.
Have anything more on Nier though. Play the demo if you have a PS4, it's good.
What it's like to work for a small indie games company after having been at the likes of Activision and Bungie and working on games like Halo. What is it like going from that to a team of, what are you,
four people, including me. It's nice. I like it. there are limitations, and we try to take them into account, you know, and you just don't have the time to get lost like you can on a big budget game. If you worked at a large company and you were making something big, you know, like Final Fantasy 15, for example, just to pick a random example, you could spend a lot of time just kind of like exploring things,
right?
You could perhaps spend a very long amount of time like trying to figure out what your game is and things like that. And as a small team, as an indie, you don't have that luxury, and it's kind of nice in a way. You have to make choices and kind of stick to those choices and see them through.
So you guys are, what's your studio makeup look like?
So there's Zach Barth. He's the creative director and designer. Then there's Keith Holman, who's a programmer. Kyle Steed is an artist. And then there's me, and I do the writing and the audio. And that's the four of us. And we made Shenzhen.io in about 5 months, all told. Four of us.
Yeah, so that's the biggest difference, right? Is when we talk about budgets and sizes and everything, what we're really talking about is time and the amount of time you can spend on a game. So you've come from a world where you're spending 3-4 years on the development of a single game, and now you're spending 5 months on one. So practically speaking, what are the differences there?
There's a lot of, I feel like on AAA games, there's a lot of time spent at the beginning that's like trying to like figure out what the game is and sort of like
pre-production,
blue skying things like, oh, this would be cool. And oh, that would be cool. And you really don't actually make the game until maybe the last year of a AAA game. This is my sense, especially because I was a producer at the time, working as a producer. It felt like a lot of the first year of a big game is just kind of like making things up and who knows if they'll really work or not. And then it's the last year where the game actually gets made. It's the last year where things actually
Where you crunch.
You have to make, to crunch. And you have to make like the actual hard decisions that you were putting off before, because now it's time to actually do stuff and you can't put things off anymore.
Mm-hmm. Because when you're making a game and you don't have that time, how does that change how you're making it? I mean, did you guys know going into Shenzhen?
Shenzhen.
Slaughtering the pronunciation. Shenzhen. Did Shenzhen. You know, like, this is what this game is going to be?
Yeah, we kind of did, actually. Zach was like, I want to make kind of a sequel to TIS 100, which was
it helps to have one guy who's like, all right, I want to make this.
Yeah, and he had a really good idea of, like, what it was going to be going in. He was just like, it's going to be like this. You put chips down. He had a very, very clear, like, idea of this is exactly how the game is going to be. And so then we just made it. And that's why we were able to make it so fast.
Do you want to describe the game, by the way, to people who haven't played it?
It's a game about designing circuits and programming in assembly language. So it's not really for everyone. You put chips down on a circuit board and you try to fulfill certain design constraints that are put on you. You play as an electrical engineer who gets a job in China making electronic gadgets, and you have to actually really do work. It's a programming puzzle game, but it's actually really just like programming, really. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of Steam reviews on the game that are like, I program at work and then I come home and I play this game and it's like doing more work. So
was that people saying that that's a bad thing, or people saying that they like that?
The Steam reviews are positive. Some people say that in a bad way, but I would argue that it's like, it's the good version of what your job is.
Right? I've been talking to my girlfriend who owns a shop in Portland and runs a store here about, she doesn't really play many video games, and about the sort of appeal of games that are actually a job, because that's become sort of more popular. I was playing a VR game called Dead Hungry, where you're in like a food cart and there's zombies coming toward you and you have to physically make food really quickly in a whole bunch of different stations and then throw the food at the zombies so that they eat it. It's a really fun game. And she's like, okay, but that's just like, they put a zombie layer over having a big crowd at a food cart. Or how Papers, Please is like this really engrossing game because it's almost a one-to-one of your desk and you have an actual desk. And how like there are these games where people do their job, where you do a job, but it's sort of different, right? Because you're getting like really clear feedback you kind of complete things, and it isn't like your actual job programming where, you know, whatever, you get no feedback and you don't know how you're doing.
You never have to like sit in a meeting for 2 hours. Have to like redesign something because somebody wanted something different. Like, once you make it,
it's the similarities between Shenzhen and my job is that your music is playing behind both, so it has that.
That's cool.
It has that in common. I've been struck by that because I don't do any programming, but that's always been the sort of barrier for me for getting into Zach's, you know, more programming heavy games.
Yeah, Shenzhen is definitely one of the even more esoteric things that he's done.
It seems like people, I mean, that we've gotten emails from readers who've been like, you should write about this game, and we're all like, we haven't played it because we're dumb and we like playing games where you shoot things.
There is a cool solitaire mini game inside the game that you should play.
Yeah, I saw something about
that. You can actually buy the solitaire on its own as like $3 on Steam, and it's good. It's a good solitaire variant.
Is it a different take on solitaire?
It is. It's Shenzhen solitaire, and it has its own rules, and Zach designed it, and it's actually pretty cool.
So it's also worth noting that Zach, your boss and the director of Shenzhen, created Infiniminer, which is the original game that inspired, or I should say that Minecraft cloned, to create the worldwide sensation that
is
Minecraft.
Inspired is a good, is fine.
So the diplomatic Zach Barth is a super talented designer.
Yeah, he's a smart guy.
Going back, and I know that we all want to talk a little bit more about like small games versus big games and indie versus AAA and stuff like that, but I imagine one of the most important parts to making a successful small game company is having that guy who clearly has really strong game ideas and visions and knows what the fuck he's doing and is able to communicate that to you guys.
Yeah.
Is that a safe assumption to make?
I think definitely. Like, Zach is not like a lot of designers that I've worked with in that he doesn't sort of like say, well, let's just throw some mechanics together and the game will sort of naturally come out of that. Mm. There's a lot of people who do that. And I think you can arrive at interesting things that way, but it just takes a long amount of time, right? Like you are constantly playing the game and like tinkering with mechanics and playing with this and playing with that and taking things out and putting things back in, and that's great if you can afford that, you know, if you have the time for it. But if you're like a small indie developer, and especially if you're making these kind of niche games, I think you need to have like a stronger sense of what you're doing before you start developing it. And that's sort of how Zach approaches things. He sort of has a very stronger, like a strong design idea of what the game is going to be, which is not to say that there isn't some iteration that happens over time as we play it and see how people react to things. But things, you know, you just don't have time to like redesign the game. The game is pretty much what it's going to be.
Right.
It sounds kind of like because you guys are such a stripped down operation and you have exactly one person for every major role. There's just like art. And I mean, I guess you're doing two roles, music and writing, programming and design. And because of that, that kind of makes the game very focused. But then, like, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Like, you know, you guys make games that are that way because, you know, that is a reflection of the team that made it. And that's sort of the sense that I get from how you talk about development.
Yeah, and there's fewer people to, like, argue over things. Like, mm-hmm. like sure, like, when you're making a game, you could make anything, right? So picking what you're going to do it's actually the hardest problem.
Right. And having a guy, and like having a guy just say, "This is what we're doing.
This is what we're doing," and it makes mm-hmm. it easier. Mm-hmm. You know, if you write and you just face a blank page, it's like you could fill that blank page with anything, mm-hmm. right? And it's hard to choose. But if someone says, "Hey, I need a story about someone who wanted a sandwich and couldn't get it," then that's like right. a prompt, right? It's like a writing right. prompt, and then you can come up with something. But you need something to go on.
Do they get the sandwich in the end?
You want to know, right? That's storytelling. That's the magic of storytelling.
tell me what happened.
Well, you have to tune in next time to find out. Yeah, that's how I get you.
Next time on Kotaku Split Screen. There's a shot of someone eating a
sandwich. I think you just gave Zachtronics their next game idea.
Yeah.
Someone wants to get a sandwich. Sandwich maker IO.
There actually is a sandwich maker puzzle in the game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, spoiler alert.
Nice.
You have to design it. It's very difficult, but yes.
Nice.
But yeah, it's interesting hearing you talk about it, though. I mean, like, so what are some of the other big differences between making a game that takes you 5 months versus working on a game that's like a 2-3-4 year slog?
Gosh.
I like that you just described it as a slog. You're like, well, for starters, it's not a slog.
I just assume it's a slog. I mean, I also assume, and you and I, we've talked about this before, Matthew, how like there's also something really cool to being like, I worked on Destiny. I worked on Call of Duty. No, it's a totally different. It's got like pros and cons like anything else.
Yeah,
so.
There are pros and cons. I think like there's less time to get frustrated with your game, which is, I mean, you get frustrated with anything that you work on. But if you've been working on something for 3 years, like it can be really tough, especially if there's a whole year in the middle where things are kind of coming together, but not quite. There's a whole middle part where it's like you're past the cool idea stage, but you're mm-hmm. not in the like it's coming together stage.
Yeah.
And that middle part, like the longer your development, the longer that middle part is.
Right.
And that's a hard part to
and describe. Everything's just gray boxed and like you can't tell what's working.
You can't tell if it's going to be good or not. And it's like, well, maybe when the art comes in, then it'll be good.
Yeah,
like,
I'm sure
like
there's a lot of that sort of pushing it down the road saying, well, once we get the music behind the scene, it won't look bad.
Right, right. Like the drama will work because the music will come in and mm-hmm. then that will make it work. And
that's always, man, anytime in any creative or work endeavor, I find myself saying something like that. Like whether it's, oh, well, once we get someone who can cover this topic, like we'll have everything locked down, or
then
like,
well, yeah.
You know, like anytime I find myself saying that, I then immediately say, nope, like, no, that won't happen. Like just immediately, like that's a red flag, I think. And
well, so do you feel that way when you're working on something for 5 months, or is that kind of middle part just
it's like a
out?
Week
at the middle? Yeah. There's always a middle part. It's just how long that middle part is, because every game is bootstrapped in a way, right? Like every game is this weird system that has to like hook into itself and work as like this whole thing. And it's hard to get to that point because like every game has to like be bootstrapped out of nothing into like being this self-reinforcing thing.
Right.
And it's like starting an engine or something like there has to, like, it's just, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but it's like, It does feel like a chicken and egg situation a lot, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's not fun until we do this, but we can't do this until it's fun, and all this other, you know,
Yeah, which I imagine is what leads to so much crunch at the end of the project, where it's like, oh, this art just came in. Turns out it's not actually fun, so we have to go back to the drawing board on this mechanic.
And I would imagine that it gets, I mean, when the game is coming together and it is fun, it's also probably easier to commit yourself to kind of more ridiculous work commitments, just because you're like, oh man, it's good.
Right.
It works.
Then you see
this
it
is fun.
Actually, like
we're playing it. It's coming together.
Yeah.
And then you're like, and we have to ship in, you know, 4 months. So fuck. And then you crunch and know that it's good. So I'd imagine that kind of motivates it too, right?
There's a certain element of that, yeah, for sure. You know?
It's also a little different when you're working with four people, like you said before, and everyone has their own field, versus a team of 200 people, each of whom has their own agenda and opinions and thoughts on what makes the best game,
well,
and the best design or the best music.
This is all making me think of something else that I want to talk to you both about, and that's the Double Fine documentary, which
yeah,
is related to this very closely. This is, I've been watching this, Jason, I know you know because I've been texting you. This is at Jason's urging. I have started watching the now public Double Fine Adventure, I believe is the actual name of the documentary, which is, I think, 19 parts on YouTube that you can just watch. And it's the entire story from like 2012 until they launched in maybe 2014 of them making Broken Age. And sort of like it starts with them getting funded on Kickstarter and not having any idea what the game is going to be. And it's this... It's really good. We're right, Jason. Anybody with any interest in how video games are made and this stuff that we're talking about right now should totally watch it, because it gives you a really honest, good look at how a game gets made and how hard it is. And I'm sort of still in the hard part. I'm in the middle part that you were just talking about of this. And man, watching these guys, some of whom I know professionally and have interviewed and have talked to, watching them wrestle with some of the limitations and challenges of game design it's intense, man. It's a stressful
movie. Yeah, we had
movie.
Tim Schafer on the show a few months ago, earlier this year, mm-hmm. And Kirk, you should go back and listen to that episode now that you've watched the documentary.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I am, I've talked to Tim, you know, a lot of times. I used to live in San Francisco. I would see him a lot, and I've always really liked his work, so I would take the opportunity to go talk to him when I could. And yeah, he is a fascinating main character for this movie. You know, I know his tics and his various isms, but watching him as the sort of combination protagonist slash nemesis almost of mm-hmm. like parts of this production, and seeing how Double Fine works under him and his, you know, it's his brilliance, right? It's like his creative vision that drives this whole thing. But then seeing how this entire team of people is like subservient to his creative process, and just the ways, like you see him run so many meetings and you see him in charge of so many rooms, and he has all these certain things that he does when he's managing a room or keeping everybody off balance, or his sort of specific sense of humor that's always kind of like playfully fucking with you, and the way that sort of keeps everybody off guard, and then they're all trying to communicate about really dire shit at times, and he's clearly dealing with it and thinking, you know, like, is this going to be the one that finally sinks us? Like, even though they've all done this, it's really fascinating, and he makes
well,
it
he,
very
he also tends to underestimate how long things will take, and I think that he would admit to being I think everyone acknowledges that Tim is a brilliant game designer and has made mm-hmm. some brilliant games over the years, but I think even he would admit to being a bad project manager, or at least a bad at the organization and scheduling part of project managing, and I think that it's kind of testament to the biggest, I don't know, Matthew, would you agree with the statement that like the biggest problem in game development, or the hardest thing about game development, is that everyone just underestimates how long things will take?
I think that's definitely one of the biggest problems.
Definitely one of them.
Yeah, I don't know if it is the biggest problem.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel like the biggest problem is that it's a game, so you can do anything. Like, you can make a game work almost any way you want it to, right? Like, a game is, if you just say like, I'm going to make an adventure game,
which was the pitch, right,
that means anything in the mm-hmm. world, right? Like, the possibility space there is huge. So then how do you,
there's an episode of the documentary, right, called like A World of Infinite Possibilities, or
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and they're talking, and his process, there's a lot of stuff about this documentary also that's really been very inspiring for me creatively. In particular, one thing, man, there's an art episode. Oh, I'll get to that in a second, actually. The first thing that's inspired me is Tim has this process of free writing where every morning he sits down with a notebook and he just writes for, I don't know, an hour. And he has these notebooks that are just full of words. And they're all just things, him just working out ideas and writing things. And sometimes he centers on an idea and sometimes he doesn't. And he just processes things out loud. It's like the free writing technique that he learned from somebody. And it's cool to see that. And he talks about that. Basically about the blank page. He's like, you have this page, and he just starts filling it with any nonsense because it's better than a blank page, and mm-hmm. it eventually gets him to an idea. Mm-hmm. It is an interesting idea because I wonder, I guess if we have him on, we can ask him this, like if he designed his older games the same way, because now that I've played Broken Age, watching the process for especially the creation of its core idea is interesting because I've always found that game, and especially playing it now, it's a little bit of an indistinct game to me. It's hard to describe, right? Like, all you can really say about it is there's a boy and a girl, and their stories are different, and you
well,
go
it's
back
like
and forth
a coming of
them.
Age story between the
that's
two.
Vague though, like what does that mean? Like, I feel like if you were going to describe Full Throttle, like how would you describe Full Throttle, right? You'd be like, it's like a biker gang in the future and like a road trip. Like, there's like a kind of clear thing there with sure. Broken Age. It's like this kind of weird world, and there's like a sacrifice, and it's just hard to, there's no hook the way that there right. is for some of this, or like right. Grim Fandango, like, you know, yeah. like Travel Agent in the Day of the Dead,
in
like
the
it's
Day of the Dead,
yeah.
yeah.
So I wonder if his process was the same, because this does have the feeling of an idea that coalesced over a great period of time. And watching them do
well,
it.
Well, I don't know, but at the beginning of the documentary, you see him like very clearly like outline exactly what it's going to be. And actually, it's funny. There are parts on YouTube that are blurred out because originally yeah. they wanted to avoid spoilers. But yep. if you get the DVD version, it's
oh, really?
Unblurred, so you can
oh,
actually see what it is.
That's cool. Yeah, that so, part yeah, that so, part cracked me up. Where you're like, you know, there's like some huge spoiler
yeah,
about
some
what's
huge
happening.
Spoiler.
On a thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. To Matthew's point before about like there being this infinite possibility, and yeah, they talk about that a lot. But I think with this, it was like they knew, okay, this is going to be a point and click adventure. It seemed like he came up with the basic core story pretty quickly. But I think that it just became this thing where he created all these puzzles, and it's so difficult to know whether a puzzle is going to be fun until you've implemented it and mm-hmm. tried it. And then even with that, it's like with a lot of games, you can play test it and know whether when you play Doom, you know yeah. that this feels fun. With a puzzle game, and they talk about this a lot in the documentary, mm-hmm. you can't really play test it because once you know the answer, which all the designers already do, then there's no way of knowing whether it's fun.
Yeah, you
so
have
it's
to get
a lot of really in. Interesting specific challenges.
They did
to that product.
One of the ones I just watched was the Hour of Fun episode where they mm-hmm. make everybody stay in the studio late, and they like have beers
and
yeah, and like everyone who's not on the project plays the game, and they have like this one vertical slice. It's like the part in the cloud city. Did you play Broken Age, Matthew? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, it's like the part where like Vela is in the cloud city. It's
cloud
in the first,
colony, yeah,
the cloud colony, yeah. And they make everybody play it who hasn't played the game, and then they watch them, and it's really funny because you watch them all. They'll be standing like Greg Rice and Tim will be standing behind somebody, and they'll be talking about what the person is doing, and the person will stop and look at them. They're like, "Nope, sorry, ignore us. Like, just keep playing. Don't listen to what we're saying."
Yep.
And they said they're like at the time, it's kind of they were talking about how in some ways it's better to demo a game like Broken Age rather than a game like Doom, because if you demo a game like Doom and it's not fun, you're really fucked. Like it, there are just when people are like, I'm just not having a good time. Like it just kind of can mean that your fundamental, you know, thing doesn't work. Where at least with Broken Age, you know, if something isn't working, sometimes it's just a matter of making something a little clearer or communicating mm-hmm. something a little bit better. But yeah, that was a fun one to watch. It's man. So the art thing. So I was the inspiration that I got in the art thing was Peter Chan, who is a concept artist who's done a ton of stuff. And is really amazing.
He drew all the backgrounds in Day
yeah,
of the
Yeah, and he conceptualized a lot of the stuff, the early stuff for Broken Age, though they only had him for a short period of time. And there's this kind of bummer sequence where he's just out of time. I think he just had to go do something else. And he just sort of is like, all right, good luck, guys, later. And they're really clearly bummed out that they ran out of time and basically didn't use this amazing guy that was really into it, which I'm sure just happens all the time when you have a contractor like that. But he lives in Washington State somewhere in this amazing house with a barn behind it. And he just has this workspace situation figured out that I was so just green with envy looking at him. He's like, oh, when I'm having a creative problem, I just go for a walk. And then he's out
in the woods.
Yeah, in the woods with his dogs walking. I was just like, why am I living in an apartment in the city? I should have a barn with all my recording equipment.
And go for walks when you need inspiration.
Yeah,
but that's the creative solution to anyone who's feeling creatively blocked, is to go buy a cabin in the woods.
Yes, and some dogs.
Just live there.
Go buy a couple golden retrievers, get a cabin. And then a year later, once you've closed all those deals, go on a walk, and then you'll get through your creative block.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So the art section is really fascinating because it made me think about what you were talking about earlier, Matthew, where you just sort of have one person in every role. And the way they did this, and this is the way I think Tim has talked to me at least about how he really likes non-game artists, and he likes to just talk to guys like, I'm forgetting his name right now, the dude who did a lot of concept art for Psychonauts. He kind of has the same guys come work on various games. And they do this art jam where it's that guy Bagel who winds up doing a lot of the painting for the game, and the other guy whose name I'm forgetting, and some other people. Oh, and Peter Chan is there, and then later they have their internal guy, and there's sort of like just this sense that they're all just sort of drawing shit. And he kind of gives them some concepts, but it's really like a jam. He calls it an art jam. And it just is so, watching it, I'm like, okay, well, this is clearly their process, and this is how cool art gets into these games, but it also feels so wasteful or just not directed or focused. You could never make a game in the kind of time frame you guys are talking about if you have that many people just sort of inputting random ideas for someone to eventually approve and then maybe turn into something. It just feels like, I'm like, wow, they are really taking their time with us, and they're really just going to wait until they find it, which is just, I don't know. Have you found that kind of a thing in, like, when you've worked on larger teams, that more like group input, like, what are the pros and cons of that? I guess
sometimes it's valuable, right? Sometimes you really want like a lot of cool ideas from a lot of cool people. But like in a lot of the situations that I was in, especially in AAA games, like weird ideas is just not, they're just not that useful. There was a time when I worked on, there was going to be a Halo game made by Peter Jackson's company. And
oh, right. I remember that.
As part of that, like Peter Jackson's Weta workshop did a bunch of like weird concepts, and this was kind of like what you were talking about. Like they were just jamming on weird ideas. Like here's what an alien gun could be like, you know, with no real thinking about like what the gameplay would be or where it would sit in the constellation of weapons that you have available to you. You know, it wasn't like any game design. It was just like, I'm an artist and I have this weird idea for a gun that's like this.
That has a propeller on it.
Right. It could be whatever. And that just was just like, yeah, that's a cool idea. It doesn't really sit in with the conception. But, you know, in that case, I mean, Halo is already kind of like a defined world. So, I mean, if you're coming up with something completely out of whole cloth, you know, maybe it's nice to have that kind of to draw from, like to have all that creative power. But yeah, it takes time. You know, it takes patience as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I get the sense, and I think they talk about this in the documentary, that Tim is a very visual dude, though he's not an artist, but he thinks visually. And I think the way they kind of had set it up was, okay, you're going to make this art, then he will see the art, and that art will then set off various connections for him that he can then turn into something. It's just a really, I think it's the way they have to work, because it's the way he works, but it is definitely a roundabout way of arriving, where if someone could just like really clearly lay it out, they would, right. I think it would have been much easier to do, which just sounds like is more like what you guys are doing. And is it's, you know, it's not like one is more valid or whatever.
No, it's a, it's kind of a filmic way of working, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are a lot of movie directors who work in this similar way. Like they want to start with the image, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other things kind of come into place from the mm-hmm. image. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, it depends on what your process is. Certain people are very visually driven, and other people are like driven by like music, right? Like a certain song inspires like this feeling that they want to get at, and mm-hmm. then they write a novel about it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like certain things get you going.
It's also a very specific auteur-driven way, in a way that a lot of games aren't, because Tim Schafer is the writer right. and director of Broken
and
Age.
Even, I would say, even some Double Fine games aren't. Like, it seems like it was his first time kind of doing that with a game for a while, like being the project lead and the creative director.
Sure,
I guess since
yeah,
maybe Brutal Legend, I think, was the last one that he had done that.
Yeah, on. I guess so. Yeah, that makes total sense. And I can't think of anything except Brutal Legend and then Broken Age. Yeah, but... So that kind of auteur-driven thing where there's a very strong vision and there's one guy or gal, sadly most often guy, mm-hmm. who is running the project and just making all creative decisions filter through him, all dialogue filters through him. It can lead to stronger games, but it can also lead to way more inefficient projects that take forever because everyone's blocked while waiting. There's a great quote in the documentary at some point. I think Lee Petty, the art director, says, "Game development is a series of bottlenecks." Mm-hmm. Which essentially means the game development is just a lot of people waiting for other people to finish their tasks so that yep. those people can do their tasks.
You see that so often, man. You see that so often. And I know, Matthew, you were a producer. I see Greg Rice as a producer on this. And it just seems like his whole job is to just go around to people's computer workstations with a calendar and just say, so you can get this by this day and this by this day. Okay, and then go to the next person and do the next thing. And it just mm-hmm. seems like it's a crucial and yet thankless task mm-hmm. that he has to do.
Right. Just and like, organizing and putting out fires, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be like, and then when this is done from you, you have to bring it over here and give
right.
it to this person,
you know,
and then they do that part
right,
of it.
Who's relying on it.
Right.
It's funny because it's like, well, so the interesting thing about Double Fine is that, so if game development is a series of bottlenecks and the producers are there to help kind of like unclog the bottlenecks and make it so the concept art can go to the modelers and the modelers can finish so it goes to animation and so on and so on, the biggest bottleneck is at the top because Tim Schafer has to write everything right. and design everything before it can actually be made. And so you see different scenes in the documentary that are like they suggest that he bring in another writer, which he's kind of reluctant to do, and he brings in another designer at some point, but really everything just like has to come from him, mm-hmm. which is kind of a problem for the studio and one of the reasons it took so long, because there was just such a big block from at the very top of the pipeline.
Yeah, and it's not fair to him to just expect him to have all the answers like right, like he just right. dictates everything from on high and he has it all figured out, right?
Especially like, for a game
right.
like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anybody's creative process is going to be like, wait, what I really want is this, right?
So right.
You can't expect someone, even of Tim Schafer's caliber, to just like say
here
right off
is.
The bat, mm-hmm. like this is what it has to be.
Well, and right, and you can't expect him to not change his mind and like
of
have
course.
Bad
right, exactly.
days. And like, there's
man,
so much.
And I really think, like, I have a feeling that the majority of video games, or really just any major creative undertaking, run into problems like this. Like, they're all different, and we're talking about this one because they made a whole documentary about it, and we watched it, and that was really cool. But it really makes me wish that there were more documentaries of this caliber that mm-hmm. that did this, like that followed a game through its entire process. And it wasn't just like, there's a lot of video features where people go to the studio afterward and they kind of piece together that story, but there's so few. I don't know if I've ever seen another one there. I'm sure there are, but like where it's like this, where you really are watching them from day one and you're seeing these awkward meetings and these really challenging, man, there's a screenshot that I sent to Jason that I showed Matthew, that's of just their business guy, like their business director, in this one meeting where they're showing him their budget, and it's just their over budget. It's just, there's the number, it says like 3 million, and then below that it says 4.5 million, and I think that's just how much they need. And then his face, the look on his face is just,
it's a good
the,
face.
Yeah, it's a good face. It's the look of a man who just ate a whole lemon and is just dealing with this and just thinking, oh fuck, what am I going
to
do?
What can I do? Who can I sell my soul to?
Right.
Yeah, it's funny because the reason that they did this Kickstarter in the first place was to make the documentary, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's why it was founded, because Tim and other people at Double Fine were like, we want to make game development more transparent, and we'll make this tiny game. And then it blew up, obviously, right. and got to 3 million instead of 300,000. And then they obviously wanted to do the documentary too. But I don't think obviously no AAA studio would ever do that, because it would just be a disaster for them,
right. They're
for
kind
their
of almost
investors
uniquely,
to see what game development is really like.
Like, if not uniquely, they're of such an interesting size, because they're a mid-sized-ish studio with several different teams that runs really tight, but does large enough projects that you're not watching yeah. three people in their basement doing something, but you're also not getting to watch. Yeah.
So it's them and like Obsidian, and that's it, I think.
Yeah. There's like, well, I feel like, or what, Runic, I feel like, is maybe kind of like that.
Yeah, but they're like a one game studio, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah.
So it's
but
a
I mean,
different.
Just in terms of smaller. Like independent and that size, like there are a few yeah. others, but it really mm-hmm. is, it's just, it's really cool. And
it's admirable to be that transparent.
And, man.
You know, show parts of yourself that might not necessarily
yeah,
like, cast you in the best light. I really admire that. Right?
I agree. And because it's not like I'm not flawed. It's not like any of us aren't flawed and don't approach creative projects in, you know, do things wrong and figure it out along the way and like wind up making something good out of something that was once bad. I've definitely never had anyone with cameras sitting there throughout the creative process. That'd be crazy. And
just taping or meetings. That
yeah.
would be, yeah.
Oh, it would be nuts. And
not only that, it's also they have to deal with gamers reacting to like every little thing and being like, oh, this is our money.
And they have to deal with the game's press reacting to things that they don't have the whole picture on, which is, I remember something Tim said when we had him on, which was that one thing that they would do differently, right, was that that having like information only going out to backers and not going out to the press or to other people. So there was this kind of informational disconnect, which I think
I don't think you've gotten up to that episode yet, the one where they split it into two acts.
No.
Yeah, well, you'll see that. They
Isn't
talk
that where
about
I,
the press.
Because I think I'm on the I'm waiting for myself to turn up because I
oh,
know
yeah,
that I'm
you
on
appear
it.
For like a second.
Yeah. Because that was shortly after that. Because I remember they reached out to us after we kind of were critical of that move to split them up and mm-hmm. ask for more money. And it's definitely watching the podcast, it puts it in a completely different light, seeing, okay, well, so this is just how it's working. And I think they were under the impression the whole time, oh, well, we're communicating with our backers. They know what we're doing. They're watching this documentary as it comes out. They know where we're at. They want us to make a good game. Where in the press, we really didn't know. Nobody knew because they hadn't been telling us. And those videos weren't out there and those updates weren't sent right. to us. So then we just hear, oh, we need more money. And of right. course, the initial reaction to that is going to be like, you do? Wait,
you got so much money already.
You had
what
all
you
this
doing
money
with
to
that
begin
money?
With.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, of course, watching the documentary, it's very clear. Oh, yeah, they totally needed more money. Like that was right. the only option they really had.
Right, right, right. But it leads to the question, like, was there any possible way for them to get $3 million and then plot out a game that actually costs $3 million? I mean, I guess in some idealistic world, maybe there is, and they could figure out, like, using super strict mechanical formulas. But even then, you have to leave some time in your schedule for iteration, which means more money. And it's just scheduling, and to my point before about like that being so like underestimating how long something will take being such mm-hmm. a big problem in game yeah. development, that whole idea of, because scheduling is money, that's where the money goes, it's burn rate and yeah. paying people salaries, so just scheduling and knowing like it's going to take us 2 weeks to make this level, oh no, it turned out to be 4 weeks, now we have to bump everything back a few weeks, and then that just keeps happening over and over again yeah. and adding up.
It's because games are creative products, right? And so every game is different, and even if you've worked on 10 games, the next game you make will be different, there will be different things about it, so it's yeah. never entirely predictable.
Yeah, I feel like even at like the people who make Madden, or you know, definitely the people who make Call of Duty, you would know, you work there, like it's, even though there's this sense that, oh yeah, they just do the same thing every year, and
it's,
I'm sure,
really true, they do try new things.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, like yeah. they're always trying new stuff, and I'm sure the new things that they're trying are on fire for half the time they're working on them, and they don't sure, know if they're gonna yeah. work, and it's that same thing.
Yeah, Madden is interesting. I think they had to move engines because EA wanted everyone to be on the Frostbite engine.
Right.
Who knows how much issue. I was trying, when I was first putting together the stories for my book, I was trying to get the Madden people, but they weren't interested. Huh. I think because they just have no time to recuperate and recover from every single one of their game launches. Jeez, so they didn't want me to come in and like bother them.
They just don't have time for books. That kind of makes sense.
No, they're
just
don't have time for interviews.
Yeah, cranking out the next one.
Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah, I second Jason's recommendation that everybody listening watch it. It's long, but you'll get sucked into it.
It's free. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, it's just on YouTube. I just watched it on my phone over Christmas while I was, you know, traveling at my parents' house, and just kind of kept watching it. And I got really into it. And then one night, I'll tell this story. One night, I sort of woke up in the middle of the night, kind of panicking a little bit. Like I was like half awake and half asleep, and I was having this just sort of anxiety reaction, and it was to the fucking documentary, because I had just watched like four episodes in a row, really just sort of one right after the other, and it's the point at which a lot of shit is going wrong, and like there's just this sense they're all kind of at these meetings with their heads in their hands. And
did you wake up being like, oh my god, we have to shit Broken Age?
I just sort of woke up. It was really weird. It was, you know, the weird feeling when you kind of are half awake, and I just had that like anxiety of just, oh, I have this project and it's not finished, and I knew it wasn't real, it wasn't my project, but it was just something after having like vicariously experienced that.
That's so
really
funny.
Repeatedly.
Yeah, imagine being on that team.
I know.
Actually working
it,
there.
No, it made me think right in the morning, wow, I bet that like, god, I bet that there were a lot of sleepless nights for the people making that, especially because they had the weight of the world on their shoulders. They're in the conversations, they're talking about how if we fuck this up, if we have to go to a publisher now, it'll undo everything, all the messaging that we've made about this, about how it's a new world where we don't need publishers and you're our publishers. And, you know,
not just for them, but for Kickstarter games.
Exactly.
In general,
they had everything riding on it, and it had to be a success. Like now Kickstarter games are as likely to be fucked up as not. But at the time, it was
new. It was like proving that it was possible.
And and they had talked such a big game, and it was this wonderful, like watching that first episode, you know, come up against the seventh or eighth episode is really wild, just because the first episode, they're just, you know, they're riding on cloud nine, and they're refreshing, they're popping champagne. They're like, everybody is so excited. And it was this huge morale boost, and they're saying, oh, we're changing the world. And of course, the reality is much more complicated than that. And watching it come together is just amazing. And it makes me very, very grateful that there was a person with a camera in the room to get all of that, and that they let them do that, and that they made something that was so human and kind of complicated and real. I'm really excited to watch the rest of it. And yeah, I definitely think people should watch it. You'll like it if you're remotely interested in video games.
Matthew, have you ever woken up panicking about a game that you actually did have to ship?
Oh, probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of a specific instance, but I mean, I can say like, yeah, I mean,
I wake up panicking? Really?
Yeah.
Definitely. Like I've been stressed, and it's been, you know, it's been bad for my health, both physically and mentally, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad to be in a situation right now that's a little bit less harmful in that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
the thing that always strikes me about game development as I'm doing my own kind of panicky, anxiety inducing giant creative project is that like I know when I'm working like 16-hour days to finish this thing, that when it comes out, it's going to have my name on it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if I were working on something where I was one of 300 people working on it, and I was just like an artist or producer or whatever, I'm sure I would be proud of my work, but it wouldn't be nearly as rewarding as something where I knew it was just me. So that always struck me as like one of the hardest parts of putting all those extra hours and freaking out over the job, which I guess is much nicer when you're on a small team.
I think, you know, there's an element of pride in your studio, though, right? Like, even if your name is not on the box, your studio's name is on the box, right? And your studio has, especially if it has a certain reputation, right? If you work for a very well-known company, for example, like Double Fine, right? Like, you do want whatever you make to live up to that name. So it's like self-pressure does absolutely exist.
One, most companies do a good job of getting you on board and almost tricking you into thinking that.
Yeah,
you know,
I feel like that's kind of twisted because they can lay you off at any time. And
well, I mean, and we get our name on stuff, but it's the same thing at where we work.
I mean, I guess we feel the same way about Kotaku.
Yeah. It's someone in the documentary, and I think it's Lee Petty, but I might be wrong about that, is talking also about a thing that happens in games where I think it was him saying that he worked for a while maybe it wasn't. I'll just say it wasn't him. It was somebody in the documentary about working for a while. And I think it was at LucasArts or at another studio, and basically working on four projects in a row that didn't get made. And then finally getting to make it. And so then he's like, look, I just want to have my name on a game. I just want to have a, like, on my resume, be able to put, I made this
a
game
that actually came out.
Because that would suck. That would suck. That happens too.
People work on prototypes or whatever, and they go from one prototype to the next prototype. And games get canceled.
That was the I think the people who made the new Gears of War were like that. Like they had done, wait, what's that studio called?
Oh, it's called The Coalition.
Black Tusk. The Coalition, Black Tusk.
It used to be called,
Before and that, they had been doing ports and kind of other, like, they just hadn't,
they
and they had canceled projects.
Stuff,
and, and it just, and then it was finally like, you know, we're doing this game. Like, I think that that feeling
at
is
at least when you
very
work on
galvanizing.
Gears of War 4, you know you're not going to be canceled.
Right, exactly. It's like, okay, well, we've got this mega franchise.
Really goes
right,
wrong.
Right, you know? It's coming out. Like, we're making a new Halo game. Yeah, we're making a new whatever. You're pretty on solid ground, and it's probably a nice feeling just that thinking, okay, God, I'm gonna, like, my resume will now have a shipped game on it.
I understand that pride in the studio thing, because I also feel the same way about, like, Kotaku, and I want Kotaku to thrive, and I feel pride even though I don't own the brand or whatever.
But you're
still feeling
right.
Yeah, but it's also the flip side of that is that every single year studios just have these crazy layoff cycles and just seem to treat their employees like they're cogs in a machine that can be replaced easily. So there is kind of like it does almost feel like are you a sucker if you believe in your brand when your brand doesn't necessarily feel the same way about you?
There's definitely the thing with crediting that I've heard just from people, mostly anecdotally, that video game crediting can be a real mess, just where people will get laid off or will leave a project after working on it for 5 years and then get their names basically removed from the credits or get some shitty credit. The main place I saw that happen was, what's his name? The art director on BioShock Infinite.
Nate Wells,
who was art director, who I like interviewed at E3, was one of the three guys they trotted out at E3 way back in the day. And then he had, you know, they were holding him up as the guy who like envisioned Columbia and did the whole thing. And then he left that game before it shipped. And in the credits for that game, he's just like, special thanks. And it's just like, wow, like that sucks. That sucks that you
I
would
feel
just...
like that's a company's way of punishing someone.
Yeah,
for leaving
I think it can be done. And I don't know, obviously, why that happened. But yeah, I think it can be done punitively. And it's shitty. Like,
it depends on the company.
Yes.
Some companies are nicer about it.
Yes. All game companies.
No, I mean,
every game company.
I'll say Bungie was always very, very good about crediting people.
Crediting just, it hurts no one to credit everybody.
And actually, the flip side of this is that the Uncharted 4 credits at the end, there's a giant page that is like this, thank you, Amy Hennig.
Yeah, I thought that was really classy and cool. Yeah. And I'm sure Amy appreciated it. And it's also it's merited. I mean, she's an important part of that franchise.
Yeah
it just seems like it hurts nobody to do it, and it's very petty. But I've definitely heard other, you know, just anecdotal stories about that. So that's the thing where you slave away on a game and you might not even get your name in the credits. So that game development sucks. What are you doing with your life, Matthew?
I don't know why I decided to make games.
We just decided this is actually an intervention. We're gonna gonna get you to stop making video games.
Actually, we've been thinking that you need to just come write more columns for Kotaku.
That's true.
So
we need you to review more everyday things like they were video games.
Okay.
Time for a career change.
Cats.
Sandwiches.
I was thinking I could review cats.
Cats, the Kotaku
cats,
review.
Yeah.
The Kotaku review.
I'm down if you want to write that.
All right.
That sounds good.
Probably be
sounds
a pretty positive review.
I bet people would like, you could just have a lot of cat gifs. No, but didn't Gawker run an article, Cats, They're Bad? Or was that, it was Albert Rudnicka,
like,
right?
That sounds like something Gawker
it's a
would
really,
run.
It was a super good. I think it was
Cats
Deadspin,
are
maybe.
Bad.
There's
so much worse than dogs.
Yeah. I feel like I could write that article
would Cats
too.
Get a no? We would bring back the yes, no.
The yes, no.
Cats,
yes,
no. Should you own a cat? No.
Nope.
They're weird.
Not yet.
They smell weird. They'll pee on your stuff.
They're assholes.
They're kind of jerks.
Kirk, you have been trying to get to this topic for like 3 weeks now. So I have to ask you, what is the deal with underbuttons?
Oh my God, we're going to talk about the underbuttons. I'm pretty excited right now. Well, Jason, since funny you should ask about controller underbuttons, they're just something I've been really into lately.
What is an underbutton?
It's like a button, but it's under the controller.
Kind of sounds.
Why
like
does it sound vaguely sexual?
I think that's one thing that I like about it. It's talking about like, really love to just get in there on those underbuttons and like work the underbuttons. Okay, So real talk, they are, so there's a controller. I have it right here. I'm showing it to Matthew. Mm-hmm. The one I'm using currently is the Xbox One Elite controller, which is a ludicrously expensive controller that I traded in some stuff at GameStop so I could afford it. But it's $150. So it's not, it's too expensive. But it's really cool. And it's a Xbox One controller. And then there are these levers underneath. Can you see this, Jason?
It yeah, but kinda, nobody else can, so no, it's I not know. Really helpful I just wanna, for well, you.
And we're going to start with the people on the show seeing it. So basically, it looks like a little spider underneath the controller, and there are these sort of levers that
you
can
pull with your fingers. Wait, hold on a second. Why would anyone spend $150 on a game controller?
It's a really good controller. I mean, there's a whole market for these. Like, this is the sort of really high-end, because like all the streamers use like those SCUF controllers that they're always talking about.
That seems fucking crazy to me. Like, I use a DualShock 4, and it's perfectly fine. It costs like $40.
Yeah, I mean, right, but these controllers are better.
But it doesn't have under buttons.
Well, for starters, they don't have under buttons. Also, like, I mean, this the Xbox One, it has it's like really weighted and heavy and like nice, and it has, check this out.
Let me see it.
You ready? I'm gonna blow your mind. Whoa, it just comes off. What?
Why is that?
Do you have to describe what you're doing?
I know. So you can just take everything, the thumbsticks come off. Everything is magnetic.
But why is that an advantage?
Well, because you can switch in other thumbsticks. It comes with like a bunch of custom thumbsticks that you can do.
Right now, Kirk is this is the least helpful podcast ever. Kirk is passing around an Xbox controller.
I'm talking about what it does. Anyway, yeah, the controller is too expensive. I think I don't think anyone should really pay that much for it unless you have like money to burn.
It is nice. It's
really play games.
Feels good in the hand.
Yeah, it's like it's
got a nice weight to it.
Mm-hmm. So there's that. But then, so it has these four reprogrammable tabs that go kind of underneath. So you use them with your middle finger and your ring finger on both hands. And as you play, you can program those buttons to be anything. So you can make custom, like I use it on my PC, and I've got custom setups for every game that I play. And I wrote an article about this. We can like link in the post or something. But basically, it totally changes how I play games with a controller. You can, like a lot of games, I'll make one of the little under buttons will be the jump. So now when I'm playing Doom, for example, I jump with this with just by like flicking, like, you know, picture you're holding a controller. I flick my left middle finger just on this little tab that it just rests on to jump. Uh-huh. So I no longer have to hit A, which means my right thumb doesn't need to move off of the looking thumbstick. So I can just keep independently moving all the time. And I'm jumping around and I'm aiming and shooting. So it's actually closer to playing with a mouse and a keyboard, where you're jumping completely independent of your head motion.
That's
so
smart.
So it's that kind of thing. Or like in Dishonored, I have the lean set to one, and I have, like the zoom. And it just makes, it becomes, your fingers never move. Like my index fingers just stay on the ends.
It's the opposite of the N64 controller, which has three different places to hold
it. I see why this is cool. Because your thumb doesn't have to switch between the face.
You just convinced Matthew to spend $150 on an Xbox controller.
Well, no.
If only there were like an $80 version.
I get
of this
it.
Thing.
Your thumb doesn't need to move back and forth.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, when you're like a pro, so a lot of like streamers and like pro gamers use these, and there must be restrictions on using them because it's a serious advantage. Like using them, if I were playing like Overwatch on PS4 and I could use like a SCUF with four buttons underneath it, which I haven't tried one of those. I don't know how reprogrammable they are on a console, but it's totally wild. It's like better than just doing bumper jumper and jumping with the shoulder button. You can just jump around and aim constantly, and it really makes games feel differently. Like Dark Souls, playing Dark Souls with this thing, you can put your attacks and your roll down to where you can constantly have control of the camera. Mm-hmm. You never need to let go to like do anything really to roll or to
this
dodge.
Is like the equivalent of performance enhancing drugs in sports.
It's really wild. Like, and it's funny because I really like controllers in general, and I like input methods and people like coming up with interesting physical ways for us to interact with technology. And I've always thought about like, okay, I like the weird evolution of the game controller in general. I've always sort of enjoyed watching it go from the weird Xbox controller to the better 360 controller, and then now the Xbox One and the DualShock 4, which are both really good, and sort of seeing which of these things will take. The under buttons are legitimately a like serious advancement, to the point where I think if you were using one and you were competing against people who weren't, you're at a disadvantage using it. And it just, I don't know, I've been rediscovering all these games and coming up with little custom templates to play them all, and they're all really cool. Playing Dark Souls with this thing is cool. Playing The Witcher, I figured out a whole way to like have my attacks and my dodge on the little under buttons for The Witcher, and it's really great. Dishonored
is there an equivalent awesome. Of this for the PlayStation, or is it only an Xbox
so
thing?
This is the PlayStation. I think Razer makes one, and but no, Sony hasn't done it, and apparently I think there's a market for this. When I wrote about it, there are people who are like, oh yeah, I totally bought one, like I shelled out and got one. And I do think there are people who play enough games and like controllers enough that just say, look, yeah, I don't know.
I play enough games and I wouldn't spend 150. Maybe if it was like 100 or 80.
Well, that's you. But
it.
I mean, I think that there is like enough of a little niche market that would pay a lot for a good controller. So you can get like, I think there's Razer ones and Scuf makes them. A couple other companies make them. And I haven't tried all of them, but they do make them for consoles. And like imagining playing Destiny where you could jump without moving your thumbstick, like playing as a hunter in Crucible and being able to jump and aim at the same time. It'd be baller. You would wreck people. Like you, I would. Yeah. It would be so. You'd be so much better. I am become very enamored of this thing and of just watching this and seeing, okay, is this actually going to be a thing? Like, are the next controllers that come out for the next console going to just have this standard?
It's kind of surprising that they haven't thought of it before,
yeah.
right?
Like, it's a little bit of a pain. Like, you press the buttons accidentally sometimes and stuff. Like, they need to fine tune it. But it really is a cool little physical evolution of a controller that everybody, I think, agrees is good. But, you know, it makes it even, like, it just gives you a few more options.
Do you think being able to play the piano helps you press more buttons with your ring fingers and middle fingers?
It's funny because it is kind of, like, what I'm talking about is this, like, move toward even more fucking buttons on a controller, which is, like, not what your average, like,
it feels like an instrument. Like, holding it, it kind of feels like an instrument.
It does have that feeling. Because you really, like,
levers kind of feel like a woodwind instrument. Like, you're playing levers on
it. Like a flute. Like, the pinky keys on a flute.
Yeah.
And it has that. Well, and, like, your fingers are all set on buttons. So it really is very, like, okay, I can't move anything. Like, it's not a very casual way to play. And really, like, I feel like there's also this move in the opposite direction, like playing VR games. It's all about like creating really like really intuitive controllers that as much as possible totally remove buttons from the equation, so you just have grips that work with your hands and like and then motion controls and that's it. And that's so much more intuitive, and that's where like new people can play, where like there are already too
this
many
is
people
like
who,
moving in the opposite directions, right, like and adding even more buttons.
And there are already so many people who just look at a controller and just think, nope, not interested.
Just go, nope.
And now you're like,
this.
Oh, and now there's buttons on the fucking bottom. So like
we added four
cool.
more
yeah,
buttons.
We added more buttons. So, you know, enjoy being even like more confused by this thing. So that does seem kind of like, I don't know, it's interesting. It's in one ways it's a refinement of a really existing cool idea, but in another ways maybe it's just moving even farther into a rabbit hole that'll eventually
farther away from reality.
Yeah, and that'll eventually just be replaced by I don't know what, holograms.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So let's talk about Star Wars. So
okay,
consider this
Star
your
Wars
spoiler
talk?
Warning. If you have not seen Star Wars Rogue One,
yep.
Now is the time to tune out until next week. But because we are going to spoil the movie. Matthew, you've seen it, right? You've seen Star Wars?
Yep. Yes, I have.
Excellent. Let's talk about it.
Cool.
First of all, Felicity Jones, the most beautiful woman on the planet? Is
I
that
like
fair
that,
to say?
I like that Felicity Jones has been helpful for me, I think, identifying Jason Schreier's type. Because I thought she was
as
cool.
As opposed to my fiance, who is not helpful for you identifying my type.
Well, that too. But this sort of a vociferous reaction to an actress, I think, is new for you.
Well,
so
I like the badass woman who is just like taking over the galaxy and just like doing her fucking business. Like, doing what needs to be done, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought she was okay. I thought I wanted more of her, like more about her character.
A little more character development would have been.
Yeah,
well, it was very clearly. And Matthew, I'm curious to hear your opinions on this, but it felt almost like video gamey in that it was spliced together from a lot of different pieces.
There was a lot to the movie that was video gamey. Actually, there's a whole part near the end that just feels like a video game level.
That's true. In fact, it feels like World War II, Call of Duty.
It does. Do you remember the part where they land? And on the beach planet, and
yeah,
they kind of there's a loading dock area with
yep.
just little bits of cover strewn up.
I
remember thinking that looks like cover that a level designer placed down, and they're gonna have a little pitched battle there, like around the cover. Like it just looked like you when you walk into a space in FPS, and you know that like the encounter designer has just set up these little cover nodes for you to like hide behind,
like,
and it looked exactly
because
otherwise
everywhere.
Why would you just put have little barrels here and there, like just one in ones and twos? There's no reason for you to do that in real life,
right?
So when they put them down in this video game level, I was like, oh, they're gonna have a little video game battle sequence, and they did, and it looked exactly like you expected.
Like what
it
you were
to.
Picturing.
yeah So I feel like video games kind of influenced the movie in multiple ways.
I was thinking specifically like Destiny style, like, shit, we don't have a story here, we have to splice all these things together.
That feeling right throughout the movie of sort of.
Well, like, there were parts, and I talked to you a little bit about this, Kirk, I think, is, like, there was one part where Jin, what's her name? Jin?
Jin Erso.
And the dude, Cassian, that's his name, right? Cassian.
Yes.
Jin and Cassian are, like, in the elevator riding together, and it looks like they're about to kiss, but there has been no love story
outside of that.
This one shot.
That's a good point.
And it felt
point.
Like there was a love story just cut out of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Which is fine with me, because there did not need to be a love story. But I did notice that
totally
scene, and
fine.
I thought, oh, shit, are they going to make out at the end of this movie? Because I really hope
they
don't.
No, but they didn't. It just feels like it was supposed to be there, and it was very clearly spliced out, and probably for the best, because it was a great movie, I thought, and it didn't need a love story at all. But it was just funny to watch, because I was like, wait a minute, like, something feels off about the way this is cut.
Well, so there were a lot of scenes for me. So I actually didn't love the movie, really. Like, I really liked parts of it, and I thought it was cool, but on the whole, it kind of... The first half just like really didn't work for me very well, and then the second half had some really cool stuff that I didn't think was necessary. So I was pretty medium on the whole movie, even though I, you know, in general there were definitely things I liked about it. And some of the stuff, it definitely just struck me throughout as a movie that had a lot of production problems, which I wasn't expecting, even though I guess I'd heard that it was getting recut and stuff. I was just really not aware of that.
Yeah, there were all those rumors floating around.
But there was, man, so the scene that really, a couple of scenes really stuck out to me. The one that really stuck out to me was when she is reunited with Forrest Whitaker's character. And it's so oddly shot. And I just immediately noticed, okay, they're not showing these two actors in the same frame. And so it shows her, and then it shows him, and then it shows her, and then it shows him, and then it shows him, and it's like the back of her head, so it's like some double, it's not really her. And you just never see their faces reacting to one another when the scene is supposed to be a reunion with basically her adoptive father. And there's just, it's so weird, and he's acting really weird and like breathing through this thing, and just, it just totally failed to connect at all, because the whole thing was shot almost like they weren't in the same room and it was edited together. And there were a lot of moments in the movie where it just felt like, it felt like pieces. It felt very mechanical, like these pieces are being assembled into a thing that will like get us from point A to point B, but not
AKA Destiny,
right? Like, or like
or
yeah,
a lot
like
of video games,
exactly.
A lot
like,
of video game
yeah,
stories.
That's true.
It's like, oh, we need a scene that takes us from X to Y.
Let's just connect them.
We'll just do it.
And so that threw me throughout the movie. And then my main criticism was that I wish it had been a little less Star Wars in general. I know that Andre Desplat, the composer, was replaced on this movie sort of last minute, like pretty near to the end, and they brought on Michael Giacchino, whose music is like a really capable, really successful dude, but his music has never done
did
much
Lost.
For me. I think Lost is actually some of his best music. I like his
music
for
Lost.
But
Lost music
so often I'll hear his soundtracks and they just leave me cold, because there's no melody I can really grab onto, and no, it just is a lot of sort of just sounds and just kind of driving orchestra thing, and then like vague sort of melody that like indicates whatever. And I thought Rogue One had the same problem. Like, the new theme for Rogue One didn't do anything for me. The And then it was, the soundtrack just kept echoing John Williams' score. And so they would play the old
theme. How come they didn't have a scroll at the beginning with the John Williams music?
I was fine with that. I think that was that seemed like a very clear stylistic choice to say, this is not a mainline Star Wars movie. This is its own thing.
But for not being a mainline Star Wars movie, they really tried to hammer home that you were in Star Wars.
That was the thing. And I feel
this reference and that reference. And look, it's this thing. It's that thing.
And they're really just, I felt like there must have been a version of this movie, at least a draft of the screenplay or something, that was way less obviously Star Wars and like didn't have a whole huge space battle at the end where like, you know, Red Squadron shows up and like is shooting everybody and it's like all this Star Wars shit happening. And then at some point someone said, okay, look, this is our just big December Star Wars movie. This just needs to be more Star Wars-y. And I would love to hear that original score because I really like his music in general. And I bet it's really interesting and I bet it's a lot less Star Wars-y. And that would, I think just that, if you like recut it with a different soundtrack, it would substantially change the feel of the movie.
It's possible that it will be released. Sometimes they release rejected like soundtracks.
That would be original soundtrack. Awesome. Mm-hmm. And then people would cut together like a fan edit.
Oh yeah,
get it. DMC'd.
I actually feel like that last battle was one of the coolest that Star Wars has ever done.
It was amazing.
Like, felt.
And I feel weird complaining about it because it was amazing. It was amazing. I thought it was awesome, and it was super fun, and the mustaches were great, and whatever.
It was like very Normandy.
Mm-hmm. But it did feel weird, right?
Like it seemed like it was maybe the original. This is just my guess, but mm-hmm. the original was a little bit more kind of morose and a little bit more like mud and dirt and
just I mean, even the plot development that got them there, right? Like it was, they went and they were just going to do this kind of black bag operation, and then suddenly they're like, oh, they went, all right, we're all gonna go too, and suddenly we're having a huge space battle.
Oh wait, we do need a big space battle, so then Rebel Command,
like someone
like,
called
oh,
Rebel
no,
Command,
okay, we are gonna do this,
which again, hard to complain about.
Why couldn't the dude Mads Mikkelsen's character, why couldn't he just be like, oh, and the weakness is in the vent shaft, all right, see you guys.
That kind of standard Star Wars contrivance. My big one thing that I really wanted this movie to do differently is the Darth Vader scene. I think this movie should have cut the first Darth Vader scene entirely.
Oh yeah,
I thought that scene 100%. Was super weak and dumb, and especially because
joke. Oh my god,
it was so stupid. I was just like, oh man, it's like Darth Vader's got to show up to like reinforce his brand
and make a weird pun about aspirations.
Yeah,
and
like choke because that's what he does. Right. He shows up and force chokes people, and it was just so. And it was a goofy scene, and his body language is kind of goofy. And I was like, oh yeah, Darth Vader is kind of a goof. But if they had just not had that scene and there'd been kind of references to Vader throughout the movie, and then the only time he turned up is at the very, very end, which I thought that sequence was rad. We didn't see it coming.
Decking like, everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just the doors open and his fucking lightsaber lights up and then he just destroys dudes and you're like, oh my God, it's Darth Vader. And he's just killing everybody. That would have been amazing. It would have been so much better than first we've already seen him and he's had this dumb, like jokey thing.
Yeah,
so
and
I
he has
really
a weird argument with the guy. It's
yeah,
kind of
just a really dumb scene. And so, and that was, and that kind of gets to my whole like too much Star Wars thing. Like just less of that, and like use it more judiciously. Though I loved the ending sequence. I think when it dawned on me that oh my God, we're gonna do the actual beginning of New Hope. This is gonna directly transition into the beginning of that movie. I didn't see that coming. I thought that was really cool.
Well, that made sense because it was this. Literally took place like the day before New Hope started.
Yeah,
this
right. Of course.
Just when
I
haven't seen New Hope in a while, but I feel like in New Hope it's kind of implied, or you feel like the rebellion has been, or the battle between the rebellion and the Empire has been going on for a lot longer. But this shows us that it just started, which is kind of strange.
I think the sense I got from the movie was that they had been fighting a war for a while, but it had been like really like insurgent war. It was a lot like a. More of a, like, you know, behind closed doors, assassinating people, trying to get information, and less of a full, you know, squadrons fighting one another kind of a
deal. But I got the sense from Star Wars, the original Star Wars, that it was like, this has been, they've been, the Rebellion and Empire have just been going at it for years.
Well, it was a little confusing because they've been training and they all have call signs and they have a whole organized, like, space
navy.
Exactly.
So, well, everything in Star Wars is weirdly time compressed, right? Like, the Empire itself is not even that old. Like, if you saw A New Hope as a kid, you would think that the Empire was, like, thousands of years old.
Right.
And then it turns out it's, like, 20 years old. something.
Right, because like, the guy from the prequels is in this movie.
It's not really.
And the kids, they were just kids.
It's like, also the First Order in The Force Awakened also just came up.
No,
right.
It's true.
Really quickly.
It's funny that actually I was thinking about this recently. There's the scene in Force Awakens, which is a beautiful, great scene where Harrison Ford, she's like, the Jedi, I thought they were legends. And he's like, no, it's all true. It's all real. And I'm like, dude, this was only like 30 years ago or something that this all happened. Or maybe I'm wrong on that. But like, it was within a lifetime ago. We're not talking about like, oh, like King Arthur
thousands
and the
of
Knights
years.
Of the Round Table. Like, I thought that was
like
legend.
No, we're talking about like the 70s.
Yeah, like we're talking about like FDR. Like,
right.
And the New Deal.
That was so long ago. It's like, well, not really.
FDR is real?
It's
I guess
real,
if you're all on different planets,
deal.
It's a little bit different. It's harder to get information around when you are living on Tatooine and something just happened on Hoth.
Right. And the Force. I mean,
I love the idea that there would still be people who don't believe in the Force when very clearly it like works and exists. Like the movie's just over and
over.
I mean,
hold on, Matthew. You realize that right now there are people who don't believe in climate change?
Yeah, okay. That's a good point. I guess. Yeah, those people, like being a Force denier when like people are like throwing you around using the Force.
It's
seems
funny.
Kind
I
of
thought
oh, this could be explained. This is the Chinese hoax. This guy choking
some
me.
Guy gets on TV.
I just feel like,
oh my God.
Yeah.
I've thought about that only because I thought about it with Force Awakens, because really if you look at the original trilogy, no one saw the Force stuff happen in those movies. So that does make sense. Like it was just Luke fought Vader. That was it.
Right.
Or like,
and it was mysterious. It was like a mysterious.
Yeah, like
secret
no one saw that. Like
the,
that's just a thing that happened. For all they knew, there was just a big space battle, and like some shit happened. Who knows?
But
like,
even if you okay, so but then in that case, you look to 60 years ago when the Jedi were like,
that's
when there were a lot of Jedi.
Problem. Yeah, and there's like dudes everywhere, like fucking force lifting their like groceries out of the car, and like everyone has a lightsaber, and you're like, okay, wait a minute, this wasn't that long ago,
right?
Did we really just erase all of this when they killed the Jedi, or what? Yeah.
There's a lot of, it's Star Wars is such an interesting franchise because it's so massive and so interesting in so many ways, but so like fundamentally
it's actually
broken
really, it's
in
actually,
others.
I was kind of thinking of it, about this because I've been playing the Skyrim Special Edition, but like Skyrim is another example of something that feels really big, but if you think about it, it's actually really small.
Yeah, and they're constantly like, they convince you, they're tricky about convincing you that something of small scale is much bigger than it actually is. It's like
Skyrim
what will befall
feels so
our,
big but
our
like,
town of five people.
Right, and there's like castles in the distance and you're like, oh, that's so amazing. But if you think about it, it's like the castle is like half a mile away.
Yeah,
it's like
it has,
not that
and
long.
It has a staff of three.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's, there's nothing in it.
The scale
Matthew,
is small.
Have you been playing Final Fantasy 15?
I haven't. I've been putting it off. I'm going to. I'm actually looking forward to it, but no, I haven't been playing it.
I'm asking because I'm curious as a fellow JRPG nerd.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we'll have to get into it next time we have him on.
Yeah, Kirk, you got to finish, and then we can bring Matthew on and have like a spoiler cast.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Kingsglaive though.
Speaking of movies,
that sure is a movie. Yeah, it's Rogue One.
No, it's bad.
Yeah, I'm never going to watch it.
No,
I appreciate
it's fun.
It. The,
that's the thing. I had fun watching it. It's just not a story. It's very clearly like
Maddie's.
Just
like you did not have fun.
I know. I like the setting. Like I like their weird like kind of fantasy and also modern life kind of thing that they have going on. Like weird magic and then also Audis just driving around because it's like real life, but not. But yeah, it's a bad movie.
Yeah, it's funny.
Well, the game, if you like the setting, you'll like the game.
Well, the game itself has flashback cutscenes that are the movie.
Yeah,
so like
so
stuff
funny.
Happens in the game and then you'll see like a cutscene, but it's actually just
a scene from the movie.
Yeah, and you can tell because it looks different than the game. Like it has movie production values and just looks really different.
Yeah,
you're like, wow, it's a hell of a cutscene for some character I've never seen before.
Right.
It's pretty funny.
You'll see, that game is the definition of like something that it's a patchwork video game that's clearly assembled from many years. Like, it's too bad that because of Japanese culture and secrecy and NDAs and whatnot, the story will probably never be told of like happened to Versus over the years.
An entire video game version of the scene between Forrest Whitaker and the girl in Rogue One.
Exactly.
It's just like weirdly
disconnected.
I feel like you can probably like piece a lot of it together just by playing the game and just being like,
make some guesses anyway.
To some extent, but it's also like, and it's not really clear how much of it was Nomura's vision before the director change happened and how much of it was pieced together at the last minute. And I mean, the rumors are that there were story rewrites on 15, like going all the way up to last year.
Yeah, I mean, you can even see the fact that they're still patching in stuff and they're still changing it now. I mean,
Yeah, well, like the Kingsglaive movie scenes weren't in there a couple of months ago, and I played a preview build. They were added recently, like within the past month or two.
Wow.
So it was like clearly they had some people playing and they didn't understand the full plot. And like, so
maybe if we put in some out of context shots from a movie, that'll explain everything.
This movie that by itself also makes no sense. If we combine it with a game that makes no sense,
they should just make everybody watch the movie. Like the first 2 hours of the game is just watching the movie.
I think they would lose a lot of people.
Yeah, you think? I think they probably would too.
No cutscenes.
A lot of people played Final Fantasy 13, and that basically
that was fine. I liked Final Fantasy 13. Okay,
yeah,
I played all three Final Fantasy 13s.
Wow,
yeah,
that's impressive. Did they get better?
No, they don't get better.
They stay
pretty Final Fantasy 13-ish. Mm-hmm. Even though they're all different, they all have different
approaches.
They do, but you know. Huh.
They're all very Toriyama. They're very lightning centric. Mm-hmm. Did you play any? Kirk, you played the first Final Fantasy 13.
Yeah, I played 13. I reviewed that. That was the first game I reviewed for Paste. Yes, that was a game. I think I described it as a richly burnished chair that's missing a leg. It just seems like that was it's like a beautiful piece of furniture that is missing a crucial part.
Yeah. Or maybe it's missing two legs and then you get one of the legs like 10 hours in.
The 10
other
hours
leg
in.
Just
yeah.
never.
It converts into a stool.
That's a good way to think it. Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely because
you have
like,
to stick with it for a really long time.
Honestly, even after that, like throughout the game, it always felt like there was just some crucial aspect missing to it that just wasn't. Like, it was really beautiful
just
and
coalesced,
worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just was missing.
Maybe that's a game where everyone was like, oh, this will be fun after we finish it. The artisan, after in the last 6 months.
It'll we'll finally get fun. Never
did. That'll really sell it. Yeah. You need the art in there.
I bet the story of the development of that is a good one.
So we have to wrap things up. Matthew, anything you would like to plug before we call it a day?
Well, if you like programming and assembly language sorting out race conditions and debugging, check out Shenzhen.io on Steam. And Solitaire, cool. It has a cool Solitaire minigame designed by Zach Barth. It's really cool.
And the soundtrack is very good. I'm not just saying that because you come on our podcast and we think you're cool. It really is nice music to work to.
So that's on
Bandcamp.
It is really good. I've been listening to it a lot. I've listened to the Undertale soundtrack.
Positive and really nice.
Just like kind of background working music. So that's
Matthew, where can people find you?
Me on Twitter. They can find me on Twitter, Matthew Seiji. Matthew and then Seiji. On Twitter.
Seiji.com.
What is Seiji? Where did that come from?
Seiji is my middle name.
Ah,
Matthew S. Burns.
That's the S in the Matthew S. Burns.
It's funny because it's a nice non rich white dude middle name in the middle
it's the
of
only, yeah,
Matthew S. Burns.
It's the only part of me that's not kind of overly generic.
Right.
That Matthew has that is very sound. Common.
And Kirk, we can find you wherever. I don't even care that much. So
I'm in Portland. I'm going to be in Indiana.
Everybody knows where Kirk is.
We can find you on Kotaku Split Screen every single week. Mm-hmm. All right. That is it for today.
Yep.
Next week, we will probably be back with our every single game of 2016.
If we don't do that, it's Matthew Burns' fault. So
yes, sorry, that's guys. True. As always, it is Matthew Burns' fault.
Yes.
And I think that's it.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you guys for being here. Matthew, thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
We will speak to you soon.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
See ya.
See ya.